Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our IQ window forecast about 84 degrees and extremely humid outside.
The spice expands consciousness.
This is where the past meets the future. We are continuously exploring the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And this month and last month, we have been exploring the mysteries of the Earth, like the most fascinating things have to do with humans and their amazing behaviors. The solar wind tonight is 457 kilometers per second, and there are four sunspot clusters on the sun today. A pair of coronal mass ejections launched into space yesterday by erupting solar filaments. However, they are going to miss Earth. No fear. The odds of a geomagnetic storm this weekend are very low. Got a couple of announcements I would like to make while we play through the intro music. Of course, our call-in number tonight is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Free in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us by 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537 coming through the wonderful, peaceful place of Paradise, California. I also wanted to let you know we have a couple of crowdfunding efforts going. This is a lot of fun for people to participate in, and it's fun for us too because we get to raise some funds for a couple of projects that are near and dear to our heart. The first, of course, is the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. You can become part of it. Yes, you can become part of history by going to fundanything.com, fundanything.com. Put in the search term Hollow Earth. Some have already gone there and contributed. Everything from free access to the online broadcast that will be coming up next year to the free t-shirt, a parka, some very, very cool stuff there at fundanything.com. Do a search for Hollow Earth. The other project that's near and dear to our heart, of course, is the electric car company, Vision Motor Cars. You can find that by going to Indiegogo. That's Indy short for industrial, I-N-D-I-E-Gogo.com. And do a search for electric truck. You'll find that there. And there are some very cool stuff there. Hats, shirts. You get even 6 months with the truck to do with as you please. Drive where you want to drive it. Do what you want to do with it. You can go to there, Indiegogo.com. Check it out. Help us out. It'll help you out. You can become part of history. Also, don't forget, we had an upsurge in the sale of Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, and that's good. We like to see people buy that book because it is a self-help book that helps you figure out how to put your dreams into the future and sort of influence the universe to do your bidding. The nice thing about this, it makes the future into the quantum foam that it is supposed to be instead of mapped out for us by some prognosticator, prophet, predictor, whatever. This is what's going to happen irrevocably, and there's nothing you can do about it. That is far from the truth. There's everything you can do about it. One of my best friends told me today, you are your own rescuer. Cha, I like it. Nobody's coming to the rescue. Rescue yourself. Read the book, rememberingthefuturebook.com, if you don't want to buy it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. If you buy it at the website, of course, you get the audio version for free. So if you're not a good reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. And, of course, you'll get the book autographed, sent to you directly from my warehouse here in an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Also, a little bit later in the news, we're going to cover the advent of 37 states that are in some process of filing nullification acts against the federal government, basically telling the federal government, get out of our state with respect to certain things. Now, several legal minds will have you think that this is fruitless, pointless. There are other ways to fight the federal government, and this is not one of the constitutional ways. Far be it from the truth, because states have the right to form what is called a constitutional convention. You read about them in school. Congress had them, the Continental Congress, and then another couple of conventions since amendments have been made to the Constitution. It takes 75% of the states to, or I'm sorry, 67% of the states to form a constitutional convention, and 80% to 75% actually, but 80% because that's the way the number of states we have in the country works out to 40 of them, would be required to ratify any amendments that are made or any that are appealed. And that's what the book Alienated Nation is all about. So if you bought it, I'm asking you to buy another copy, find your governor's mailing address. It probably has to go through some kind of clearinghouse, and mail him a copy of the book. They must get this book in their hands, Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty. It explains to them that if these 37 to 40 governors get together and form this constitutional convention, we can rescue the republic. And it's going to need rescuing. It's going to need you, as you will find out tonight. Our phone number again, 888-429-5471. Here we go. Recent story. This came out last week. A Black Day for Liberty. This is the name of the article. It's by Peter Scheer. Just a really, really good writer, and he does a good job putting this together. This comes through the Information Clearinghouse. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has dealt a terrible blow to Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, and Noam Chomsky. You'll know those names. Those are famous activists and other journalists suing to prevent the indefinite military detention of American citizens. You know, and I know, we have the constitutional right to due process and a speedy trial, and we have the right to face our accuser. Well, not if the military steps in and detains you. I know exactly what you're saying. You're saying, but wait a minute, doesn't that mean that you have to be a military combatant? Don't you have to be sort of incarcerated on the battlefield or in the active insurrection against the United States? You know the whole thing, enemies, foreign and domestic. And the answer is yes, in the historic interpretation of the Constitution. But Sections 1021 and 1022 of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012 would allow, and by the way, this is not Bush's NDAA. This is the one that was signed into law in the dead of night with an extra rider on it, which overrode, by the way, against the Senate's wishes. The Senate actually removed this clause from the NDAA, and the White House put it back in. It would allow the military to detain indefinitely persons who are deemed to consort with terrorists or those who would commit, and this is in quotation, belligerent acts against the United States. Journalists, whose job it is to be belligerent, would undoubtedly qualify as belligerent, Hedges has argued, and I think rightly so. I've listened to the argument myself. Chris does a great job of explaining. It is the press's job to find fault in the leadership in order to keep their toes to the line, to keep the lights turned on in the dark, smoke-filled back rooms. The plaintiffs have had successes and also setbacks in court. Here is what Hedges wrote after Wednesday's decision. Now, I want you to play this back if you're listening to it as an archive. If you're listening to it live, driving down the road, or while you're working on your favorite project right now, listen closely. These are Hedges' words. This is quite distressing. It means there is no recourse now, either within the executive, legislative, or judicial branches of government, to halt the steady assault on our civil liberties and most basic constitutional rights, you know, the original 10. It means that the state can use the military, overturning over two centuries of domestic law, to use federal troops on the streets to seize U.S. citizens, strip them of due process, and hold them indefinitely in military detention centers. States that accrue to themselves this kind of power, history has shown, will use it. We will appeal, but the Supreme Court is not required to hear our appeal. It is a black day for those who care about liberty. As I said, it is very, very important for you to get a copy of Alienated Nation, The New Path to Liberty, into the hands of your governor. I would, if you could, buy a copy for every one of your state senators. Get it into their hands. Let them read the book. It is 250 pages, not a hard read. It cuts to the point. It outlines things exactly the way they need to be done. It lists the amendments that need to be repealed, 16th, 28th, so forth, and it allows them to put other amendments into place, 29th, 30th, 31st, 32nd, and 33rd amendments. I know you haven't heard of them yet. Unless you have read the book, you would not have. But these are key to saving the Republic. If they don't do it, the Supreme Court cannot help them. Now, here's an example. This is a former Navy SEAL, and he tells of forced incarceration under the Obama regime. And this goes all the way back to 2009, and it is not exclusive. I hate to tell you this. It is not exclusive. It is happening right before our eyes. Well, I should say maybe not right before our eyes, because you may not know anything about it. Literally, you might be misinformed or not informed at all, in which case you're not able to make intelligent decisions. Here we go. This is an article by Sharon Rondo, by the way. In an initial interview with the Post and Email, Mr. Harry Galvin Butler III said that in late 2008 or in early 2009, all he wanted to do was point out that Barack Hussein Obama was a phony and see Congress act on it in the interest of national security. I'm sure he's not alone in that either. Instead, he ended up spending virtually the entire year in federal prisons awaiting a, quote, psychiatric evaluation, close quote. Butler is a proponent of the U.S. Constitution and the Second Amendment and perceived that Obama, by virtue of being a phony, was playing with my Constitution, he said. He told us that Navy SEALs and other military members hate phonies. He has no previous psychiatric history, nor does he have a criminal record. Last August, former Marine Brandon Raub was arrested by the Secret Service and FBI, taken into custody and placed in a psychiatric institution where he was told he would be forced to take medication, which he did not want. Can you say Thorazine? He was freed approximately 1 week later after a federal judge reviewed his detention and found no probable cause by which to hold him. Raub's plight was taken up by the Rutherford Institute, which is suing the government for an unspecified amount of money. Keep in mind that you could only hold someone legally 24 hours without charging them. He was held a week. Now, he also had the unbelievable luck to have a federal judge review his detention. That has already been written out of the new procedures. Federal judges don't even know this stuff goes on. Your name goes away and you're given a number. Now, in a May 22nd, 2013, this is just a couple of months ago, Rutherford stated, the complaint filed in federal court in Richmond alleges that Raub's seizure and detention were the result of a federal government program codenamed Operation Vigilant Eagle that involves the systematic surveillance of military veterans who express views critical of the government. So if you wear the uniform or have worn the uniform recently, be careful if you are expressing views critical of the government. They know that you're trained. They know that you know what you're doing. And you are, for all intents and purposes, a trained killer. Institute attorneys allege that the attempt to label Raub as, quote, mentally ill and his involuntary commitment was a pretext designed to silence Raub's speech critical to the government, and that the defendants violated Raub's rights under the First and Fourth Amendments. Following Raub's highly publicized case, and again, I say, Raub was extremely lucky in having his case even noticed, Rutherford revealed that hundreds of other military veterans had contacted them to relate similar stories of government intimidation and people, quote, disappearing. Rutherford Institute President John Whitehead stated that Brandon Raub's case exposed the seedy underbelly of a governmental system that is targeting military veterans for expressing their discontent over America's rapid transition to a police state. Now, I am going to go a little bit more into the definition and the implementation of what a police state is. You and I, maybe most of you Earth explorers, know what police are. We see them every day now. But when we were young, police had a little different serve of different purpose in the community. They served a different purpose. It used to say on the door of the police car, to protect and to serve. It doesn't say that anymore, I'll guarantee you that. Well, 2 days before announcing the civil rights lawsuit, Whitehead expounded on Operation Vigilant Eagle, which was launched by the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and the FBI to observe veterans for alleged signs of extremism and oppositional defiance disorder. Yeah, it's a disorder. It's called ODD. Oppositional defiance disorder. It means that your oath that you took when you raised your right hand in your civilian clothes before you got your first haircut and before you got your first shot in the arm and your first uniform to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It means that that oath has turned into a disorder called oppositional defiance disorder. It means not doing what you're told, and even worse, it means that you're not allowed to say, hey, wait a minute, sorry. Whitehead also wrote that the government is issuing the charge of mental illness as the means by which to immobilize and disarm these veterans. And it's diabolically brilliant. With one stroke of a magistrate's pen, these servicemen are being declared mentally ill, locked away against their will, and stripped of their constitutional rights. They cannot earn a living. They cannot vote. They cannot drive. They cannot use a passport to leave the country. They are not eligible for a loan. Their credit report is frozen. Their personal records have a permanent mark placed on them. They may be placed on a no-fly list, which means they can't even fly inside the United States between states. May not even be able to buy a bus ticket or a plane ticket. You get the idea, don't you? Make no mistake, these returning veterans are being positioned as enemy number one. And you're not left out. I'm getting to you. You are enemy number two. Navy veteran Darren Wesley Huff is presently incarcerated today in a federal prison in Texarkana, Texas, resulting from a false FBI affidavit and prosecution witnesses who perjured themselves on the witness stand in front of a judge after Obama operatives reported threats to the Monroe County, Tennessee courthouse, which were never uttered. The Post and Email has reported in depth on the targeting of veterans under the Obama regime. Notice, by the way, this program did not originate the term Obama regime. X Squared Radio has no official opinion on this. We are just reporting what has been written in these original reports that were written by various journalists. But isn't it interesting that we call it a regime instead of an administration? It is not under the Obama administration. It's under the Obama regime. Look it up. I'm going to continue. This is included in the Sovereign Citizen Program, described by the FBI as including those who make references to the Bible, the Constitution of the United States, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, or treaties with foreign governments. Both Huff and another Navy veteran, Walter Francis Fitzpatrick III, have been characterized as, quote, sovereign citizens in a law enforcement training program produced in Tennessee. By the way, Tennessee, as you know, is the fourth state in the Union, but used in various forms across the country. Butler served as a Navy SEAL from 1969 to 1973 and was in the reserves from 73 to 75. Following his release from the Navy, he attended Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida, where he went through the professional pilot program and obtained the necessary FAA flight ratings. From there, he went to work for Gulfstream Aerospace, flying the world's elite to their places of business and play. He became a captain and worked for the airline for 20 years until his retirement for medical reasons in 2002. But that would have been that would have been 27 years after he left the reserves as a Navy SEAL. Of his flying training, Butler told us, "Before I made aircraft commander, I personally made sure I had 5,000 hours of flying time. Then, when it came time for my pilot and command check ride, I told the check airman that I wanted no slack. He put me through the ringer, and the ride took 2 days. I did this for one reason. I knew that one day I'd be fighting an emergency, and people's lives would be in my hands. I wanted to prove to myself that there was no emergency I could not handle in the cockpit. I took all those long years of hard work, study, spending every penny I had, and the VA also helped." Butler absolutely loved his career. He loved to fly, and he was good at it. He said he retired from Gulfstream in 2002, which he hated. He was 52, at the height of his career, and senior demonstration pilot in the flight operations at General Dynamics Gulfstream Aerospace Corporation. However, Because of medical complications and increasingly long flights, Butler said he chose retirement because I would not have been able to make it otherwise. He added so reluctantly, kicking, screaming, I retired from a job I loved. I was young, I was in shape, I could do the job, but I retired. I tell everyone I never worked a day in my life at Gulfstream. However, I did have one long love affair with the airplane, with flying, and with doing my duty. Following several life-changing operations, Butler said he was handicapped, but he's not handicapped, although he has trouble walking. Before Barack Hussein Obama was elected in 2008, Butler became alarmed because he believed and still believes that Obama is not a U.S. citizen. Remember I told you last week, all you really have to do is come up with the term birther. And keep in mind that this term was originated by the CIA. It was designed by their program. They came up with the label. They implemented the label. They marketed the label. And now anybody who questions any of the fraudulent documents that were used, and I would say after the fact, to verify that he was eligible to run for president, anybody who questions these documents is immediately termed a birther. Just like the term conspiracy theorist was used by the CIA to classify anyone who said they heard more than one shot or one shooter during the Kennedy assassination. Now, of course, it's common knowledge. Everybody knows. But the 35,000 people that said they heard multiple shots from multiple directions, they were labeled conspiracy theorists. The instant somebody came up with that, with a statement or a question, they were immediately labeled and obfuscated by the press. Now we have the same thing. They're called birthers. Well, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 of the U.S. Constitution requires that the president be a natural-born citizen, although Butler is certain that Obama meets neither the definitions of U.S. citizen nor that of natural born. Butler said he called his representatives in Congress to no avail to warn them that a foreign national was about to be sworn into the office of president and commander in chief. In a recent email to this writer, that is the writer of this article, not me, the writer of the article, as I said, is Sharon Rondeau, and she is with the Post and Email. And so let's see here. She says, Butler wrote that Obama is guilty of being a phony, ineligible to be eligible, unfit for command, and has committed abuse of office. Butler said that after he began sending emails and making phone calls to members of Congress, agents from the Secret Service began visiting members of his family, as his address was unconventional and not easily found. He has been told by his family members that they were inundated by lies from Secret Service agents stating that he was not in his right mind. They used the power that they wield by being a government employee, which is ludicrous. It's wrong. It's illegal. If there's any way we can stop that, it will be a huge plus for this country, Butler said. They all do the same thing. Butler's not sure when the Secret Service began contacting his family members. However, he said that they were surveilling a friend of his in their black SUVs, describing it as dirty, dirty pool. In our previous interview with Sharon, Butler told the Post and Email that his family members brought him to a psychiatrist at the urging of the Secret Service, then a hospital, both on the same day. He reported being told that he would be given a medication, which of course he refused. Butler was then surrounded by a dozen men whom he attempted to fight off despite his physical challenges, but was finally subdued by an injection of medications which was forced on him. He says when he woke up, his arms and legs were in chains. Butler was taken to the psychiatric wing of the hospital where he remained for 2 weeks. He was then moved to what he called a private prison in Ocilla, Georgia, in Irwin County, where he spent about a month. Butler was told that he was there for a psychological evaluation before a judge could make a ruling on his case. He had neither seen nor been told of any criminal charges having been filed against him. The criminal complaint, which Butler said he paid for and received only a month ago, states that he made threats against Obama, a claim that Butler refutes, never made. Butler told the Post and Email that he never threatened bodily harm to Obama. Seals don't do that. Butler explained that before Obama's first inauguration, he was trying to get Saxby Chambliss and Johnny Isakson to wake up. This guy's a phony. This guy's a phony. I was writing them and calling them. So when they say they weren't aware, that's BS. You can see all these lies and distortions in the complaint. The thing is, if you do this to the President of the United States, it only takes one Secret Service agent to have you incarcerated. Nothing happened until Obama was inaugurated. When he got inaugurated, the very first thing he did was seal everything in the world related to him, even before he came after me. The order for me to be arrested came directly from the White House. You can bet your bottom dollar on that, Butler said. All of this is illegal. These guys get away with it for one reason. They have tons of money and power. All of this corruption is done by threats and money and pressures from the government. That's where it all comes from. That's the thing that fuels all this corruption, Butler told the Post and Email. The amount of money to facilitate this cover-up is a figure beyond anyone's imagination, and it's not a problem. The rich and famous don't think about money because they have so much. They don't worry about it. It's common to say they do worry. The Post and Email asked if marshals escorted him to the door of the facility, to which he responded, "They take you to the front gate, and that was as far as they go. You're in chains. Anytime you leave a facility, you're in chains. There are two sets of cuffs. The ankle cuffs are wider than the wrist cuffs. And then you have a chain that goes around the wrist cuffs, around your waist, in an overhand knot, and it goes down to your legs." The Post and Email asked Butler how he felt after having served his country as a Navy SEAL and being placed in chains, to which he said, "You feel terrible." He reported that he sometimes spent 14 to 16 hours a day on a bus, which caused him great discomfort as a result of his medical condition. They give you a bag with a sandwich and an apple in it. "But try to eat a sandwich with your hands chained to your waist," he said. When we asked, "How do you do it?" he said, "You can't. Some of the guys will nudge it a little bit, but you can't get anything out of it." We asked if the marshals helped at all in his situation, to which Butler said, "No." Following Ocilla, Butler was taken to a facility in Miami, Florida. And that's where the article stops. Now, as I said, you and I have a different viewpoint of law enforcement. We grew up in a different world. Excuse me while I take a sip of my orange juice. Hold on. There is a solution to this. And the solution might be personal, and the solution might be involve your household or your community, your state, and eventually your nation. And I want to talk to you about that this hour. I totally invite your comments, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. There was a movie that came out last year. It was called The Avengers. And in this movie, one of the immortals, whose name is Loki, he's Thor's brother, kind of a mischief maker, but a very, very dangerous person, comes to Earth and tries to start an interdimensional war, which he succeeds in doing. But he couldn't resist coming to this earth being thinking that he's all by himself or wanting to incur the wrath and to be incarcerated by the rest of the superheroes and the Avengers craft. This is what he said. It's a famous speech. I'm sure you've heard it, but I want to play it again. I want it to sink in this time. You listen very closely to the words. Here we go. This is when Loki walks out of the museum.
Kneel before me. I said, is not this simpler? Is this not your natural state? It's the unspoken truth of humanity that you crave subjugation. The bright lure of freedom diminishes your life's joy in a mad scramble for power, for identity. You were made to be ruled. In the end, he will always kneel.
And one man stands up when Loki says, in the end, you will always kneel. One man stands up and says, no, not to men like you. To which Loki responds, there are no men like me. And the man defiantly looked at him and said, there will always be men like you. On January 4th of last year, a local narcotics strike force conducted a raid on the Ogden, Utah home of Matthew David Stewart at 8:40 p.m., obviously after dark. 12 officers were acting on a tip from Mr. Stewart's former girlfriend, who said he was growing marijuana in his basement. Mr. Stewart awoke naked to the sound of a battering ram taking down his door. Thinking that he was being invaded by criminals, as he later claimed, he grabbed his 9mm Beretta pistol. The police say that they knocked and identified themselves, though Mr. Stewart and his neighbors said they heard no such announcement. Mr. Stewart fired 31 rounds. The police, more than 250. Six of the officers were wounded, and Officer Jared Frankham was killed. Mr. Stewart himself was shot twice out of 250 rounds before he was arrested. He was charged with several crimes, including the murder of Officer Frankham. You can imagine 281 rounds blasting off in just a few seconds inside this dark house. Sounds like Mr. Stewart was a much better shot than the 12 officers. Half of them were wounded. The police found 16 small marijuana plants in Mr. Stewart's basement. There was no evidence that Mr. Stewart, a U.S. military veteran with no prior criminal record, was selling marijuana. Mr. Stewart's father said that his son suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and may have smoked the marijuana to self-medicate. Earlier this year, the Ogden City Council heard complaints from dozens of citizens about the way drug warrants are served all over the city. As for Mr. Stewart, his trial was scheduled for next April of 2013, and prosecutors were seeking the death penalty. But after losing a hearing last May on the legality of the search warrant, well, Mr. Stewart hanged himself in his jail cell. The police tactics at issue in the Stewart case are no anomaly. Since the 1960s, in response to a range of perceived threats, law enforcement agencies across the U.S. at every level of government, and you've seen them in your own town, have been blurring the line between police officer and military soldier. driven by martial rhetoric and the availability of military-style equipment from bayonets and M16 rifles to armored personnel carriers. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Even Fargo, North Dakota. Fargo, North Dakota, with two homicides a year on average. Two. Last year spent $3 million on military paraphernalia, outfitting, armor, weapons, and an armored personnel carrier. Yes, $3 million, Fargo, North Dakota. Go figure. American police forces have often adopted a mindset previously reserved for the battlefield. The war on drugs and more recently a post-9/11 anti-terrorism effort have created a new figure on the U.S. scene, the warrior cop. Armed to the teeth, ready to deal harshly and mercilessly with targeted wrongdoers and a growing threat to familiar American liberties. What was that you said? Did you say, are you speaking to me? Did you look at me? Did you not get your driver's license out quick enough for me? The acronym SWAT stands for Special Weapons and Tactics. Such police units are trained in methods similar to those used by special forces in the military. They learn to break into homes with battering rams and to use incendiary devices called flashbang grenades, which are designed to blind and deafen anyone nearby. Believe me, if you've ever had anything like that go off, especially in a closed area, I know. You see it on TV all the time, or you see it in the movies all the time. And then, you know, you see the person or persons crouched behind a ordinary particle board coffee table that has just repelled machine gun fire from the front door. And they say to each other, "Hey, what's going on?" And the other one says, "I don't know." Let me tell you something. That many rounds go off in a room, even 22 caliber, which those are not. We're talking 9mm and 223. Believe me, you're not hearing nothing. Nobody is going to hear anybody say anything. I don't even care if you're shouting. You're deaf, and you're deaf for days. Their usual aim is to, quote, clear a building. That is, to remove any threats and distractions, and unfortunately, that includes pets, and to subdue the occupants as quickly as possible. As I've said, that's not the police force that we're familiar with. This is the police force that I grew up with. Listen.
Well, well, well. So we're gonna have visitors.
Looks like.
Well, I'll tell you something. Those two hoods are in for a big surprise when they get here. They're going to come in here expecting to find some small-town two-bit lockup, a rinky-dink clubhouse. Well, they're going to find out different.
What do you got in mind?
I'm going to show them we're on our toes out here. That the Mayberry Jail matches any big-time pen they've ever served time in.
Barney, there's no need.
First of all, we're going to get rid of all these extra frills. We give them just what they get in the big house. One cot, one blanket, one cracked mirror, period.
Well, I guess we could take some of that stuff out. The doilies need washing.
I'll tell you something else. I said this before and I repeat it now. What we really need around here is an extra deputy.
Yeah, so that's the kind of police force that I grew up with. Andy of Mayberry. Didn't even wear a gun. Barney had one bullet, which he very nervously carried around in his front shirt pocket. To protect and to serve, to deal with altercations on a community level. That's what the police were there for. They weren't military. Today, the U.S. has thousands of SWAT teams. A team prepares to enter a house, and they do it fully armed and armored. The country's first official SWAT team started in the late 1960s in Los Angeles. By 1975, there were approximately 500 such units. Today, As I said, there are thousands of them. According to surveys conducted by the criminologist Peter Kraska of Eastern Kentucky University, just 13% of towns between 25,000 and 50,000 people had a SWAT team in 1983. That was 1983. By 2005, okay, just 22 years later, the figure was up 80%. 80%. The number of raids conducted by the SWAT-like police unit has grown accordingly. In the 1970s, there were just a few hundred a year nationwide. But by the early 1980s, there were some 3,000 a year. In 2005, the last year for which Dr. Kraska collected data, which is 8 years ago, just in 1 year, there were 50,000 raids. A number of federal agencies also now have their own SWAT teams, including the Fish and Wildlife Service, NASA, the Department of the Interior. In 2011, just a little less than 2 years ago, the Department of Education's SWAT team bungled a raid on a woman who was initially reported to be under investigation for not paying her student loans. Though the agency later said she was suspected of defrauding the federal student loan program. Missed the payment. The details of the case aside, the story generated headlines because of the revelation that the Department of Education actually has a SWAT team. None of these federal departments has responded to requests for information about why they consider such high-powered military-style teams necessary. Man, I am so grateful that I paid my student loans back on time. My goodness. Americans have long been wary of using the military for domestic policing. We've kept them separate. Why is that? Because from a sociological point of view, police are meant to take care of approximately 2% of society. That means that if you live in a city of 100,000 people, approximately 2,000 people in that city are not going to obey the law. Okay? 2%. We know from past experience that 90% of all the crime that is committed in a city is committed by the same people over and over and over again. If you were to go down to the criminal courthouse and you were to sit in the back row as a civilian observer, one of the things that you would notice month after month, year after year, as you did this, is that you see the same faces over and over again. It's the same domestic violence. It's the same shoplifters. It's the same bad check writers. It's the same pickpockets and people that break into cars and break into houses. It's the same people. Approximately 2% of the people do not have it in themselves to voluntarily obey the law. That's why you have police. That's a sociological fact. It's been that way since the beginning of time. Even the Romans only had centurions to keep the peace in Jerusalem. Centurions means 100, okay? They didn't have tens of thousands of troops in Jerusalem. Didn't need them. Didn't need them because most people voluntarily obey the regulations and laws. 2% do not. But we have seen that change. Not necessarily the number of people that won't obey the law, but the overreaching power, the intimidating power of law enforcement as a military force in order to intimidate the people who would think about maybe not breaking the law, but maybe speaking out against it. Hey, you really think this is fair? concerns about potential abuse date back to the creation of the Constitution. It's always been that way. When the founders worried about standing armies and the intimidation of the people at large by an overzealous executive who might choose to follow the unhappy precedent set by Europe's emperors and monarchs, that's why we have the rules in there forbidding government from requiring citizens to house military personnel. The idea for the first SWAT team in Los Angeles arose during the domestic strife and civil unrest of the mid-60s. Daryl Gates, then an inspector with the Los Angeles Police Department, had grown frustrated with his department's inability to respond effectively to incidents like the 1965 Watts riots, the Detroit riots, and others. So his thoughts turned to the military. He was drawn in particular to Marine Special Forces and began to envision an elite group of police officers who could respond in a similar manner to dangerous domestic disturbances. Well, as you might imagine, when such forces are trained and they are funded and they are outfitted and they practice, well, if there don't happen to be any riots going on that day, you know, you don't want your guys to get a little rusty, do you? No. So what you do is you look for other situations where they might be needed. At about the same time, President Richard Nixon was declaring his war on drugs. How's that going for us, do you think? Among the new tough-minded law enforcement measures included in this campaign was the so-called no-knock raid, a policy that allowed drug cops to break into homes without the traditional knock and announcement. After fierce debate, Congress passed a bill authorizing the no-knock raids for federal narcotics agents in 1970. Over the next several years, stories emerged of federal agents breaking down the doors of private homes, often without a warrant, terrorizing innocent citizens and families. Sometimes they reacted very badly to this. Congress repealed the no-knock rule 4 years later, in 1974. But the policy would soon make a comeback, this time without congressional authorization. During the Reagan administration, SWAT team methods converged with the drug war. By the end of the 1980s, joint task forces brought together police officers and soldiers for drug interdiction. National Guard helicopters and U-2 spy planes flew the California skies in search of marijuana plants. They do the same thing in Kentucky and Tennessee and Georgia today. Not with U-2s, but with other infrared surveillance machines. When suspects were identified, battle-clad troops from the National Guard, the DEA, and other federal and local law enforcement agencies would swoop in to eradicate the heathen killer weed and capture the people growing them. Advocates of these tactics said that drug dealers were acquiring even bigger weapons, automatic weapons, rocket launchers, mines, different anti-personnel tactics, dogs, and the police needed to stay a step ahead in the arms race. There were indeed a few high-profile incidents in which police were outgunned, but no data existed suggesting that it was a widespread problem. A study done in 1991 by the libertarian-leaning Independence Institute found that less than 1/8 of 1% of homicides in the U.S. were committed with a military-grade weapon. That's it. Most of them with knives or with legal pistols or things like that, but not a military-grade weapon. In other words, less than 1/8 of 1% were committed with what are called military assault rifles. Got it? That's what they're trying to get off the streets. Subsequent studies by the Justice Department in 1995 and the National Institute for Justice in 2004 came to exactly the same conclusions. The overwhelming majority of serious crimes are committed with handguns and not particularly powerful ones, like .22 calibers or .38s. The new century brought the war on terror. Of course, and with it, new rationales and new resources for militarizing police forces, although those statistics have not changed. I repeat, they have not changed. According to the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Department of Homeland Security has handed out $35 billion in grants since its creation in 2002, with much of the money going to purchase military gear, such as armored personnel carriers, and in 2011 alone, a Pentagon program for bolstering the capabilities of local law enforcement gave away $500 million of equipment, an all-time high. The past decade, from 2003 to 2013, has also seen an alarming degree of mission creep for U.S. SWAT teams. This is what I was trying to describe to you earlier. It's sort of like, dudes, look, we're all dressed up and we don't have any bad guys, okay? I got this nifty bulletproof Lexan shield. I got this nifty carbon fiber club. Can you imagine what this would do to somebody's hand as they held it up in resistance? I just really want them to resist. Don't you? Dudes, we got to go try this stuff out. When the craze for poker kicked into high gear, a number of police departments responded by deploying SWAT teams to raid games, you know, in garages and basements and VFW halls where illegal gambling was suspected. And you got to keep up with those pesky bingo players. Come on. Wow. According to new reports and conversations with poker organizations, there have been dozens of these raids in cities such as Baltimore, Charleston, South Carolina, Dallas. In 2006, 38-year-old optometrist Sal Culosi, good old Sal Culosi, was shot and killed by a Fairfax County, Virginia SWAT officer. The investigation began when an undercover detective overheard Mr. Culosi wagering on a college football game with some buddies at a bar. The department sent a SWAT team after Mr. Culosi, who had no prior criminal record or history of violence. As the SWAT team descended, one officer fired a single bullet that pierced Mr. Culosi's heart. The police say that he was shot by accident. Mr. Culosi's family suspects the officer saw Mr. Culosi reaching for his cell phone and thought he had a gun. Assault-style raids have been used in recent years to enforce regulatory law. What is the difference? I am so glad you asked that question. You see, agencies, federal agencies, administrations, departments, and bureaus write their own regulations that have the force of law. It's called regulatory law, okay? These are what are called parts, like Part 49 or Part this or part that, and then there are subsections and sections to this, and clauses. These are written by the agencies themselves. And what they do is they fill in the actual details and procedures for implementing a law that Congress might pass called an act. Like, for instance, the Defense of America Act, or it might be called the Glass-Steagall Act, or it might be called the Dodd-Frank Act. You see, agencies then pass regulations to implement that act. They're interpreted, of course, by the secretary of that agency. And the secretary of the agency is a cabinet member of the president. So the president directly orders the secretary to interpret or to guide the agency into making regulatory law. That's the difference, is that those bureaucrats that are inside those agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus are not elected by you. You don't know who they are. They have no connection with you. They can't be touched in any way, not by the Senate and not by the Congress. If you don't believe me, turn on C-SPAN sometime and watch the hearings for yourself. Watch the most powerful congressman in the history of the United States call these agencies to the bench day after day after day and grill them and hammer them with questions. Of course, it depends on which party you're in as to who actually does the hammering. The rest of them are there to run interference. But the point is that the agencies never answer the questions. In fact, we have recently seen the IRS, the State Department, and others simply claim the Fifth Amendment, against the act of incriminating yourself. Yeah, imagine that. They work for you, you pay them, they're running under a regulation that you have no control over, you get no voice in, you cannot vote on, you're taxed, you're fined, and you're regulated by organizations without representation. I think we already fought a couple wars over that. That's regulatory law. Armed federal agents from the Fish and Wildlife Service raided the floor of the Gibson Guitar Factory in Nashville, right down there on the parkway in 2009. The suspicion? Oh, believe me, they are really dangerous people up there at Gibson Guitar. They were using hardwoods that were suspected of being illegally harvested in Madagascar. Now, look, you can't have that kind of stuff happening, okay? But Gibson settled in 2012, paying a $300,000 fine and admitting to violating the Lacey Act in 2010. The police department in New Haven, Connecticut, sent its SWAT team also to raid a bar believed there was underage drinking going on. And by the way, I want to throw in here, you know, Gibson guitars are famous. They really are. I've had a Gibson. My band played with Gibsons. But we also played Fenders. You know why you've never heard a Fender Guitar Factory of being raided by the SWAT team, by the armed agents of the Fish and Wildlife Service, even though they use exactly the same kinds of woods in their guitars? Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. It's because Fender guitar is a big contributor to the Democrat Party. Gibson is a long-time contributor to the Republican Party. Yeah, now you know the difference. Well, for sheer absurdity, this bar where there was underage drinking going on, it's hard to beat the 2006 story about the Tibetan monks who had overstayed their visas while visiting America on a peace mission. Or about the girl that bought a case of water recently, a case of water. She was 20. Her and her girlfriend got into her car, turned the ignition on, and agents drew their weapons and jumped on top of her car, yelling and screaming at her. Her girlfriend, who was in the passenger seat, dialed 911 and told the police that there were people trying to break into her car, and she told her girlfriend, who was the driver, step on it, get out of here. And so she hit the gas, and of course the officer, the person that was on the hood of the car, fell off the car, didn't get hurt, but fell off the car, and the car sped away. These two 20-year-old co-eds, college students, scared out of their minds, these unmarked officers yelling and screaming. And you know how it is when there's four or five people yelling and screaming at you. You don't know what to do. You're going to say, oh, yes, what is the problem? Please let me roll my window down while you're holding a gun on me. That's not going to happen. Both those girls' dads said, if you guys ever get carjacked, you step on that gas and you get the hell out of there and call 911. And that's what they did. And sure enough, a minute and a half later, they were pulled over, blue lights flashing everywhere. Guess what? Yeah, that's right. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms and explosives was suspecting her of being an underage purchaser of alcoholic beverages. Water. It was water. Well, in Iowa, the hapless holy Tibetan monks were apprehended by a SWAT team in full gear. And, of course, the Tibetan monks just cleaned the parking lot with them, whipping them mercilessly. No, that's not what happened. Unfortunately, the activities of aggressive, heavily armed SWAT units often result in needless bloodshed. Innocent bystanders have lost their lives, and so too have police officers who were thought to be assailants and were fired on, as allegedly in the case of Matthew David Stewart. Now, research has shown, after collecting over 50 examples in which innocent people were killed in raids to enforce warrants for crimes that are either nonviolent or consensual, that is to say, crimes of drug abuse, gambling, in which all the parties participated voluntarily, these victims were bystanders, or the police later found no evidence of crime for which the victim was being investigated. They include Catherine Johnston, a 92-year-old woman killed by an Atlanta narcotics team acting on a bad tip from an informant in 2006. Alberto Sepulveda, an 11-year-old accidentally shot by a California SWAT officer during a 2000 drug raid. And Yuri Stamps, killed in a 2011 raid on his home in Framingham, Massachusetts, when an officer says his gun mistakenly discharged. Mr. Stamps wasn't even a suspect in the investigation. What would it take just to dial this excessive aggression back just a little bit? The obvious place to start would be ending the federal grants that encourage police forces to acquire the gear that is more appropriate for the battlefield. Beyond that, it is crucial to change the culture of militarization in American law enforcement. That's where I want to go in the next hour. Hang with me, because it's important that you hear this. It's important that you wake up, that you're aware of what's going on around you. You already know we're one nation under surveillance. You might as well know where they're coming from. Okay? Just listen up. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away. Thank you. Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I'm coming to you live, hour two, from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Thank you, Jody, Alanis, and Morgan, singing Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen's great, great song. Thank you for being part of X Squared Radio on the BBS Radio Network, the largest live webcast radio network in the world. We've been here 8 years. Very proud of it. Thank you for being part of the program. Our phone number tonight, 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. I'm making a transition here because I wanted to let you know that although I am alarmed, and you should be as well, in the militarization of the local police, I don't feel that there's a real need for it. I certainly don't think there's a need for thousands and thousands of SWAT teams across the country. I mean, bad guys have been around for a long, long time, but so are good people. And most of the time, if good people can just defend themselves, then you don't really have victims out there like we normally do. As was seen when Florida passed their concealed carry, violent crimes dropped easily by 40%. And it has been, a statistic has repeated itself every single place where it has been enacted. It is a tried and true method of protecting oneself and not necessarily standing your ground. Bunch of silliness, that whole argument. It's just the prospect of your victim being armed that deters the one who's going to be doing the assaulting. He doesn't know whether the person that he's assaulting is armed or not. That's the deterrent. Now, all you really have to do, and I encourage you to do this, is I am not going to do it here on this radio program. For one thing, it wouldn't come across very well because there aren't a lot of spoken words in these recruitment videos. But the police recruitment videos, and they're widely available. You can Google it. You can Yahoo it. You can Bing it. You can ask it. You can go to YouTube. There are hundreds and hundreds of them out there. all kinds of different precincts all around the country. They often feature cops rappelling from helicopters, shooting big guns like 50 caliber recoilless rifles, kicking down doors, tackling suspects. Come on, people. That's what not protect and to serve. These campaigns embody an American policing culture that has become too isolated, too confrontational, too militaristic, and they tend to attract recruits for the wrong reasons. They're not protecting and serving. They're intimidating. If you browse online police discussion boards, and I have done that this week just so I could make myself familiar with it, or if you chat with younger cops today, you will often encounter some version of the phrase, whatever I need to do to get home safe. It is a sentiment that suggests that every interaction with a citizen may be the officer's last. Nor does it help when political leaders lend support to this militaristic self-image, as New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg did in 2011. You're not going to believe this when I tell you. I'm going to put it in quotes. It is in quotes. He did say it, but I still think you're not going to believe it. Here's what he said. This is Mayor Bloomberg. This is the guy that took away the big gulp, okay? Here's what he said. I have my own army in the NYPD, the seventh largest army in the world. The motivation of the average American cop should not focus on just making it to the end of a shift. The LAPD may have given us the first SWAT team, but its motto is still exactly the right ideal for American police officers. It says it right on the door of the black and white unit, right under the crest. It says to protect and serve. To protect and serve whom? The American public, the citizens of Los Angeles. Okay? Now, it says that. Do they do that? Or do they say, whatever it takes to get me home safe? SWAT teams have their place, of course, but they should be saved for those relatively rare situations when police-initiated violence is the only hope to prevent the loss of life. They certainly have no place as modern-day vice squads. Okay? Fish and Wildlife, IRS, Department of Education, going after people who have not paid their student loans? Are you kidding me? Many longtime and retired law enforcement officers have told me of their worry that the trend toward militarization has gone too far. We recently had a meeting of sheriffs right here in Cabarrus County. And only one sheriff out of all the sheriffs that came from the surrounding areas, only one sheriff said that they would enforce the federal gun laws. The rest of them said they would not enforce them. They're not going to enforce those laws. Those who think there is still a chance at reform tend to embrace the idea of community policing, an approach that depends more on civil society than brute force. In this very different view of policing, cops walk beats. They interact with the citizens. They ride, a bicycle, or they just walk down the sidewalk, and they consider themselves part of the neighborhoods that they patrol. They are our neighbors. Their kids go to school with our kids. They go to church with us. They shop at the same grocery stores as us. They're just doing a part of society's job, and therefore they have a stake in the communities. But now we want them to remember that it's about baton twirling officer friendly rather than a taser toting RoboCop, right? That's what we want. And here's what we're seeing. Not just militarized cops, but militarized military. Yeah, go figure. Following up on a recent and unannounced training exercise in Florida and Washington State, and there have been a lot of other radio programs that have reported on this, and you can go listen to them if you want. They're a little bit more ranty and ravey than we are here at X Squared Radio. What I'm trying to do is make you aware of the trend, because it is a disturbing statistic. We have clearly in our list of federal regulations a barrier between using federal army troops in our cities and using them in other countries. There was a U.S. Military drill, and they were conducting a drill in Chicago. The Windy City's Office of Emergency Management and Communication, the OEMC, told the Chicago Tribune on Tuesday it is providing support for a routine military training exercise, including flying helicopters in the downtown area of the city at night. The training sites have been carefully selected to minimize the impact on the daily routine of the residents. According to the census report, 2,695,598 people live in Chicago. Population density is 11,841.8 residents per square mile, making it the most populated urban area in the United States. The realistic urban training conducted by the U.S. Special Operations Command, based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, includes the participation of soldiers from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment headquartered in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. According to the Tribune, the training is designed to prepare military personnel for overseas deployments. Now, keep in mind that these military operations were not in the neighborhood of where these bases originated. These troops were transported to an area where they wouldn't know anybody. According to the Tribune, in July, on an army exercise conducted in Port Angeles, Washington, this turned a small city into a simulated war zone, and it terrorized the residents. Thousands and thousands of citizens flooded the police with phone calls complaining about low-flying Chinook helicopters. Because of the volume of the complaints that we heard, I want to let the Army base know that if it's necessary to fly over populated areas, we want advance notice. That's what the Clallam County Sheriff Bill Benedict told the Peninsula Daily News on July 12th, just a few days ago. In January, it was reported on the U.S. It was reported on the U.S. Army, along with other agencies, taking over the Carnegie Vanguard High School in Houston, Texas. Alarmed residents called police and complained about gunshots and helicopters. Come on, this is a people that just finished watching Red Dawn. They know what's going on. They think they know what's going on. You know, we remember in 1941, a day that will live in infamy. You remember when Japanese Zeros went strafing into Hawaii? What did the people think? Oh, gee, those pesky flyboys are at it again, until the bombs began dropping. Okay? Those low-flying airplanes in New York, nothing to worry about. They're just on approach. Oh, my God, they've hit the towers. That's what I'm talking about. Earlier that month, a training exercise designed to ensure the military personnel are able to operate in urban areas and to focus on preparations for overseas deployment, they rattled residents of Miami, Florida. The exercise included simulated machine gun fire over a downtown Miami freeway. How would you like to drive through that? Earlier this month, a Democrat member of the Chicago City Council called for putting troops on the streets in response to a wave of violence. Come on. There's been, 7,000 people killed in Chicago by gunfire? That's more than have been killed in the Iraq War in Chicago. Here's what Representative Monica Davis said. I'm calling for the National Guard to come to Chicago and ride up and down these streets. She demanded the governor of Illinois, Patrick Quinn, deploy the state police and the National Guard. In addition, Davis suggested Quinn appoint a task force to guide the behavior of the National Guard. We don't want them to have us fearing them also. We want them there for safety and protection. The News Gazette reported on July 10th, the move by Davis demonstrates the readiness of government bureaucrats to propose militarized solutions to social problems. Now, I understand 7,000 people lost their lives in Chicago. I understand 90% of that death by gunshot was black-on-black crime. I get it. I get it. Where do you think the National Guard would have to be deployed? Come on, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. You know where it will go. This is a Zimmerman Warp 10, and you know it. In addition to increased military exercises, the federal government and the United States Northern Command announced the deployment of military units for domestic homeland security missions. In September of 08, the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, 1st Brigade Combat Team, was assigned various tasks, including civil unrest and crowd control, a detail that was later denied by NORTHCOM, despite the concession that forces would be armed with both non-lethal and lethal weapons, as well as having access to tanks. Now, you need to know the difference between non-lethal and lethal. Lethal weapons, we already know what those are, bombs and bullets and poisons and things like that. But non-lethal weapons are batons and rubber bullets and tasers, annoying sprays like pepper spray and things like that. And they have two different purposes. We know what lethal weapons do, right? The military comes in and they kill people and break things. That's what they do. They bomb things, they blow things up, and they shoot everybody and let God sort them out. You've heard it before already. We really don't want that to happen in American cities. But non-lethal weapons are not made to kill. They're not made to defeat. They're made to make men obey. When you spray someone down with cayenne pepper spray, or you immerse them in a noxious gas, which makes you vomit and makes your mucous membranes flood your lungs and your sinuses and your eyes, where you can't see, you can't breathe, you can't run. When you're tased and you're hit with 50,000 volts, which basically shorts out your nervous system and you fall to the ground like a lump of mashed potatoes, it is not meant to kill you. It is meant to make you obey. And even more than this, it's meant to make those who are watching it obey. Not just the ones on the other side of the street in the same demonstration, but the ones who are watching on TV. That's what the non-lethal weaponry is there for. Well, by 2011, the military planned to activate and train an estimated 4,700 service members for specialized domestic operations, according to Air Force General Gene Renault, commander of the U.S. Northern Command, which was created in 2002 for Homeland Defense missions. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, you know them as FEMA, you know, the ones that hand out the cookies and cocoa and the warm blanket when there's a disaster like a flood or an earthquake or a tornado or a hurricane, that FEMA. They added to the heightened state of domestic militarization in 2012 when it announced that it had graduated its first class of FEMA Corps members under the rubric of emergency response preparedness. Quote, While the idea of having a volunteer force of tens of thousands of volunteers scattered across the country to aid in times of natural disaster sounds great, the details and timing of this new government army is somewhat curious, if not disturbing. Close quote. Over the past 2 years, President Obama has signed a number of executive orders suspending all civil and constitutional rights and turning over management of an America under martial law to FEMA. Here and there, not nationally. Also in that time, domestic federal agencies under the Department of Homeland Security, including FEMA, have ordered billions, with a B, billions of rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, which, by the way, is in complete violation of the Geneva Convention. That is to say, we cannot legally use these rounds in warfare. And yet these agencies, including the IRS, the FDA, have ordered 40 caliber hollow point rounds to use against whom? Well, that is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Admittedly, these new weapons and ammunition aren't to be used in some far-off war to fight forest fires in California, but right here on the streets of America. So if you're going to fight a war, you got to have a reason to have a war, right? Hold on while I take a wonderful sip of my orange juice. Well, I could think of all kinds of reasons to have a war, but I don't really want to. But here's one I didn't think of. I didn't think of it. I'm sure you didn't either. Are you ready for this? It's called the Arctic Time Bomb. Mm-hmm. The rapidly melting Arctic is an economic time bomb likely to cost the world at least $60 trillion, with a T, $60 trillion, say researchers who have started to calculate the financial consequences of one of the world's fastest changing climates. A record decline in Arctic sea ice has been widely seen as economically beneficial until now. As it opens up, of course, more shipping and drilling in a region thought to contain 30% of the world's undiscovered gas and 13% of its undiscovered oil. However, the Arctic pivotal role in regulating the oceans, the salinity, the temperature, and the climate means that as it melts, it is likely to cause climatic changes that will damage crops, flood properties, and wreck infrastructure around the world, according to research by academics at UK's University of Cambridge and Erasmus University Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out their basis in observation. Obviously, open sea exposed to sunlight absorbs energy from the sun, and open ice in the Arctic reflects the sun's energy back out into space. It makes a big difference, all that accumulated energy being absorbed into the water instead of reflected off the water. This is likely to end up creating costs that will outstrip any benefits by three or more orders of magnitude. That's 1,000 times, said Chris Hope of Cambridge Judge Business School. Quote, people are calculating possible economic benefits in the billions of dollars, and we're talking about possible costs and damage and extra impacts in the order of tens of trillions of dollars. Close quote. The Arctic has been warming at least twice as fast as the rest of the world for many years, and the area of its sea ice, which melts and refreezes after every summer, has been declining by an amount almost equal to the size of the UK each year since 2001, actually a little earlier than that. Last year, the summer ice shrank to its lowest point since satellite observations started. That was way back in 1979. The effect the European researchers have focused on is the way warmer Arctic waters are expected to hasten thawing of the permafrost beneath the East Siberian Sea off northern Russia that is believed to contain vast deposits of methane. There's also another methane. It's a sea of methane that is trapped under the pressure and low temperatures of the deep sea. This is a greenhouse gas, methane, CH4. This is a, it has 20 times more potent ability to trap sunlight and absorb energy than carbon dioxide, though it does not last as long in the atmosphere. Reason? Well, it's not fully oxidized carbon. CO2 is fully oxidized carbon. The only way to get rid of carbon dioxide is either with ultraviolet radiation or with plants. That's the only way. It's the only way to reduce carbon and get the oxygen to come back off and back out into the atmosphere. Methane is quite a bit different. It is not oxidized, obviously. It can burn. CO2 doesn't burn. Burning it, oxidizing it, and it can be taken care of in a variety of ways. There's much debate about how long it might take to release these methane deposits, and that's kind of the key to the whole argument. If it's released slowly, then the atmosphere can absorb it and without any real bad ill effects. But if it comes off in mass, in huge volumes, then it can be, well, it can be life-ending on this planet. Some scientists say there is already evidence of large plumes of methane escaping, and others fear that this could happen fast enough to accelerate global warming. And once we go over the edge, it's an edge of no return. Okay? It eventually speeds up other changes, such as the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which contains enough frozen water to push up global sea levels significantly. There's a difference between the Arctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet. The Arctic ice sheet floats on the water, which means if it melts, it doesn't raise sea level at all. It's already in the sea. But the Greenland ice sheet, which is a significant continent, is land. And if that ice sheet melts, the water goes into the sea, which will raise the sea levels. That is why the group felt it was important to assess the possible economic impact of such changes. Arctic sea ice could completely vanish in the summer as early as 2015. As you know, we have a crowdfunding effort going right now under fundanything.com, fundanything.com. Use the search term Hollow Earth. What this small amount of crowdfunding money will allow us to do is to take care of some travel, some contracts, some meetings that need to take place in order to put the charter together to get this ship that can carry 124 of some of the world's most accomplished scientists up to the Arctic to try to survey this live. And hopefully you can go with us by a satellite broadcast. Now, the researchers assessed the impact of higher methane emissions with a newer version of the economic model used in the UK government's 2006 Stern Review and on the economics of climate change, which concluded the benefits of curbing global warming early, and it far outweighs the potential costs of not acting at all. Depending on how much methane was emitted, they calculated its potential cost was likely to be $60 trillion. That's more than the gross national product of the United States and Europe combined, okay? So, it's not just important for polar bears. It's also important for societies and global communities. I have said repeatedly for years on this program, and I will say it again, climate change is upon us. You're feeling it. I'm feeling it. It doesn't take a weather, a meteorologist or a hydrologist to understand what's going on. Is that caused by man-made causes? It's difficult to say. All the CO2 that we're belching out of coal-fired power plants? It could. But more than likely, these are galactic forces that are working on the planet. They're also working on Saturn and Venus and other planets in the solar system. And it has probably worked on us every time we come to this spot, every 26,500 or so years. The point is that we have made it through this before. And we can make it through it again. However, if we're adding not enough to really warm the planet, but enough to make that difference, that tiny little 2 or 3 or 4% difference that makes the difference between life surviving on the surface of the planet and not surviving on the surface of the planet. We need to listen up. Now, is this grounds for having a war against the public? I don't know. I don't think so. There are all the normal ones like, government's not doing what the people want it to do, and so therefore we want to change the government. We want to have an election or two. But unfortunately, the ones that are in power, no, not the president. I mean, yes, the president, but the one the president works for. The agencies, departments, bureaus, administration, the ones that really spend the money, the ones that really have control of the country, they're not going to go very easily. They're going to resist. Now, can I see a show of hands of all those people that have visited Washington, D.C. in the last 5 years? Excuse me while I take a sip of my orange juice and count hands. That's what I thought. Not many of you have gone there. But I want you to. I want you to take a trip to your nation's capital. Just take the tour, go to the Smithsonian, go visit the Capitol. You know, can't take the White House tour. That's been sequestered out. Now you can't do that. But you can do a lot of other stuff. But the thing I want you to notice, and it won't take you long, you can see it from a bus or a cab. You can really see it from the sidewalk when you're walking. It's a city that's on a war footing. What does that mean? If you've ever traveled to other countries, like Cairo, one of the things that you'll notice is the hotels where Americans often stay have a pneumatic barrier. It resembles a bulldozer blade, okay? Normally, it stays, you know, down. But in the case where you want to stop the traffic in a very quick and decisive way, big traffic, you know, like, not like a Prius, but something much bigger, 3, 4, 5 tons, that might be rolling down the street trying to make its way past a check station. Well, then you're going to need a bulldozer blade, right? But you don't want to have a bulldozer parked in the middle of the street stopping cars. And you also don't want to have one of those big cement things like you see on the freeway that prevent traffic from crossing over from one side to the other. You want to have something portable. And that's exactly what they have. They have the city barricaded off road by road by portable bulldozer blades or portable steel and concrete posts that come up out of the ground. Now, at a moment's notice, by computer or by remote camera, if the city of Washington, D.C. wanted to shut the city down and route all the cars out of the city, they could do it with the press of a button. Easy peasy. The whole city could be shut down. This is what I mean by a war footing. People on the roofs, you know, overlooking everything, binoculars, weapons, things like that. At a moment's notice, it's a city that could be defended. Now, it's getting ready to go to the next level. And I don't want you to be alarmed by this, but I want you to be aware. Because if you should happen to visit our nation's capital, if they actually show this on TV, you might see it. But you're going to hear about it right here on X Squared Radio. In World War I, when shortly after the Wright brothers proved that it was capable of making a controlled turn in the air without winging over and crashing. And what I mean by shortly, I mean like within a year. What happened was military commanders learned that you could fly overhead, you know, somewhere around 6 or 7,000 feet where you could still breathe. And you could drop a bomb out of that plane onto ground targets. And if you got really good at it, you could sort of gauge pretty close where to drop that bomb. Now it's, you know, done by targeting systems. And in World War II, we were getting pretty darn good at it. And by Vietnam, we could carpet bomb, and it was one of the most dreaded sounds ever in the history of battle, was the sound of B-52 flight going overhead. But one of the ways that you could stop this during the nighttime bombing was to put blimps up. You know, they're like on cables. They're lighter than air, and they often carry helium in them, and the cables are often tied to anti-aircraft guns. It helps them aim better. You know, a plane flying along would hit the cable, which would basically pull the trigger, and like coyote and roadrunner style, the gun would go off and shoot down whatever it is that hit the cable. And in cities all over Germany and also in Britain, to stop the buzz bombs, the first, I guess you would call them crude cruise missiles, that used to come over the English Channel and plunge themselves into the city of London, completely terrorizing the people, these barrage blimps would stop those from hitting. Either the cables would cut the wings or anti-aircraft fire on the ground would go off. And even in the nighttime, they could shoot down these buzz bombs as they came in. Well, they're getting ready to start deploying the blimps over Washington, okay? If America is attacked again by, say, cruise missiles, we might be saved by blimps. Not the state-of-the-art jet fighters that fly, you know, well beyond the speed of sound. Not drones, but blimps. Lumbering, relatively jovial blimps. The manatees of aviation, as it were. Within a year, a pair of souped-up $2.7 billion blimps will be floated 10,000 feet above Washington, D.C., and they will act as a 340-mile-wide eye in the sky. And, of course, they're going to be detecting incoming missiles and the like. Right here, in our own design room, we develop what's called a Sentinel. A Sentinel is a either cabled blimp that flies lighter than air fashion, or a geosynchronous one that can fly up to 100,000 feet using just simple propellers to stay in place over a city because there's, you know, no weather at 100,000 feet. These lighter than aircraft would just sit there and watch the city with high-resolution cameras, and they'd be fitted with various weapons, lasers and different kinds of high-speed projectiles and things like that. And you could literally stop anybody, from grouping together and assaulting anything on the ground. It's called a Sentinel. Well, these are going to provide a 340-mile-wide eye in the sky, and primarily they're going to be defensive. But believe me, there are a lot of accoutrements that can go on these blimps. The design and testing phase for JLENS, the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System, JLENS, produced by Raytheon, you know, the good friends down in there at Wars R Us, a major weapons manufacturer. That design and testing phase is now complete. Now it's time for implementation. They're getting away from the PhD engineer types running the system, and it's time to take the 20- or 25-year-old soldier running the system. That's what we're getting ready to see. Now, the idea to employ blimps to protect cities is actually not a new one. It was done during World War II, during World War I. London deployed a similar system to protect against Nazi airstrikes. Not the V-2s. It couldn't stop that, but it could definitely stop the V-1s, which were a kind of a single-engine buzz bomb is what they sounded like, because they had kind of a buzz sound when they went through the air. The barrage balloons, as they were called, often act as fence posts for a spool of wire that would make it difficult for planes to maneuver into the city. Basically, they were barbed wire fences suspended a few thousand feet in the air. And they were also, you know, fueled with hydrogen, which was highly flammable. So upon impact, you know, would kind of blow up. But some of them were tied to anti-aircraft guns on the ground, so they would kind of automatically fire. Now, the balloons that will fly over D.C. will perform a similar function, and they'll look kind of similar. But swap the wire cabling for state-of-the-art radar and computer processors, and these won't be keeping our Nazi propeller planes. They'll detect more modern threats, such as cruise missiles, according to Raytheon. The units will protect the city of 500 to 700% less than the cost to operate the reconnaissance planes necessary to maintain the same amount of coverage. They will provide a comforting amount of minutes rather than the current seconds of time for U.S. forces to decide what to do with the threat of an anti-ship cruise missile. Now, to think about how cruise missiles fly, they usually fly very low to the ground, and that's how they kind of avoid radar. And usually when they plan the flight path of these, they avoid all the nav aids. They avoid all the airports so that they're not picked up on airport radar. And they fly countrysides or they fly along the coastline, and then they'll turn in. And they can usually fly up to about 500 miles an hour, which means they can hit their target, you know, several seconds before you ever hear them. And at night, if they're black, they're going to be impossible to see. The blimps, or aerostats, as they are technically called, are 77 yards long, and they have a range of 340 miles. They fly at 10,000 feet for 30 days at a time. The J-Lens radars successfully tracked fighter aircraft, towed targets, cruise missile targets, meeting accuracy requirements with a margin of error. The report states a test at the Great Salt Lake revealed that they are quite capable of doing the job. Strictly defensive, of course, you know. But the interesting thing is that they are now going to be deployed over D.C. If a cruise missile was launched from a long ways off, it might be spotted. Might be spotted by a fishing vessel or a cabin cruiser or, you know, some buoy maintenance crew out there. Maybe. Maybe. But if it is designed to avoid surface contacts, which you could easily do with some satellite guidance, it would never be detected until it was too late, not at that speed. However, if it was launched much closer, for instance, say 100 miles off or 80 miles off or 30 miles off, a submarine would have to surface, launch, and submerge again. And as long as the missile didn't come up to speed until after the submarine was in the water, turning and off, you know, in its escape route, and then the cruise missile could come up to speed, you would never know what hit you. And that's why maybe they're deploying that. Just to let you know, it's a city that's on a war footing. We're not making people very happy out there. And that seems to be what's coming down the pike. Now, in the next hour, I want to talk about this, the whole idea of, you know, how the United States got to this point. Why are we facing the end of a nation? Why are we in this position? Former Assistant Treasury Secretary Paul Craig Roberts says, "The country is not being run by the president. It is being run by spy agencies and private interest groups, Wall Street and military security complex. They run the country. The president is a puppet, a figurehead." Now, this guy is the former assistant treasury secretary, okay? He says, "If you are a lawless state, which the United States is, it obeys no international law. It does not obey the Geneva Convention. It tortures people. It doesn't obey the Constitution. It doesn't obey anything. It does what it wants. If you are a lawless state, you disguise yourself as a democracy." That was said just last week. Not by somebody obscure. Not by a radical. Not even by Alex Jones. You want to know who said that? Come to the next hour. You will be absolutely amazed at who said this. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is Hour 3, July 28, 2013. If you're listening live, I applaud you. I want you to call in 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. In the last hour, I had said a quote. It says, if you are a lawless state, which the United States is, it obeys no international law. It does not obey the Geneva Convention. It tortures people. It doesn't obey the Constitution. It doesn't obey anything. It does what it wants. If you are a lawless state, you disguise yourself as a democracy. That was former President Jimmy Carter. He says the U.S. has no functioning democracy at this moment. No functioning democracy. Former President of the United States. We often hear the term bubbles. You know, we had the housing bubble. We had the dot-com bubble. Bubbles are forever, bouncing all around our brains until the next crash. Then denial. Our brain hibernates, erasing the pain, the losses. Memories are suppressed, and then the next bubble mania heats up. Like now, a new virus spreads, metastasizing, feasting on bullish market news or short-term profits. A new addiction, disease, virus, takes over the brain, exploding into a neurological social media experience, consuming America's collective brain, slowly climbing a new wall of worry, building to a new critical mass, a new flashpoint, and then ignition. The 90s dot-com mania was irrational, exuberance run amok. American investors creating a grand collective delusion of a perpetual new economy with 17-year-old CEOs whose office was in a laptop. It seemed reasonable for 19 high-tech funds to return 100% to 365% returns in 1999, where your barber's stock tips seemed reasonable, where the neighborhood barbecue was where we shared our reasonable plans to retire millionaires soon in the new millennium. But their forever bubble exploded. It popped. Shocked Americans settled into a painful 30-month recession as Wall Street lost $8 trillion. That same scenario repeated again in the bank credit meltdown, 2008. And today we're moving headlong into the third shocker of the 21st century. This time we're oblivious that history is repeating. Lessons are not learned. And it's no wonder that we are baffled. As with irrational exuberance, Schiller's Bubbles Forever looks beyond our 24/7 short-term mental trap. The warning signs began years ago in our rally leading up to the 2008 crash. Investors slowly climbed the wall of worry as media and market bulls cheered every new record. Sound familiar? The warnings were everywhere, even on X Squared Radio. But the bulls snorted even louder and pawed the ground and flashed their horns in the sunlight. And our minds were obviously more receptive to the bulls. Every Sunday business show, piled with perfectly manicured hands, making signs in the sky of giant dollar signs. Look how great the economy is going. We've had 40 months of continuous growth. This president is doing a marvelous job. Just look at Wall Street. Look at the Dow. Have you ever seen such a magnificent number in your whole life? Ringing the bell in and ringing the bell out as the numbers go higher and higher. Are the big banks really as powerful as some people say they are? Do they really control the global economy? If you ask most people, they would tell you that governments control the global economy. But the campaigns of our politicians are funded by the ultra-wealthy, the big banks, and the large corporations that they control. Others would tell you that the Federal Reserve and the rest of the central banks around the world control the global economy. But the truth is that the Federal Reserve was established by the bankers and for the benefit of the bankers, not for you. When they print that $85 billion a month, do they write you a check? Do you see any of that money filtering down to your checking account or to your business or to your local bank for you to borrow for your business? No. At the very core of the global economy, there exists a super entity of financial institutions that control an almost unimaginable amount of wealth and power. How unimaginable? I'm glad you asked. These financial institutions and the ultra-wealthy individuals behind them, and there are not very many, are really the ones that are pulling all the strings. In this world, money equals power. And the borrower is the servant of the lender. Make no mistake, he who controls the debt controls the world. When you follow the pyramid all the way to the top, you might have to hold your breath because it's way up to the clouds. It becomes very clear who really is in control. in business schools all over America this very day. Instead of dreaming of starting new businesses and contributing something positive to society, most business students are dreaming of going to Wall Street and getting rich. But Wall Street doesn't actually create or build anything of value for society. Instead, the bankers make most of their profits by essentially pushing money and paper around and making a fee. In a recent article, Chris Martinson commented on this. Here's what he said. Today, some of the most celebrated individuals and institutions are ensconced within the financial industry in banks, hedge funds, and private equity firms, which is odd because none of these firms or individuals actually make anything, which society might point to as additive to our living standards. They don't make cars. They don't make cell phones or clothing. They don't grow food. They don't synthesize drugs. They don't make airplanes or anything. Instead, these financial magicians harvest value from the rest of society that has to work hard to produce real things of value. While the work they do is quite sophisticated and takes a lot of skill, and there are a lot of losers and very few winners, new products and new innovations are not abounding. Instead, they either trade in the secondary markets for equities, bonds, derivatives, and the like, or for actual cash, which perform the service of moving paper from one location to another while generating profits. Or, in the case of banks, they actually create money out of thin air. Wouldn't that be nice? You don't have to win the lottery. You just print the lottery. And then you lend it out. At interest, of course. So you're not just making the interest. You're also creating the money off which you're making the interest. Now, I'm going to list for you 18 things here. You might want to write them down, but you don't have to. According to the Bank of America Merrill Lynch equity strategy team, their big institutional clients are selling their stock at a rate not seen since 2008. You know how I know this? Because I myself bank at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. It's true. I hang with these guys. Not the guys in Wall Street, but my local guys. And this is exactly what they're telling me. You want to know what to do? You want to know how to position yourself? You want to be in the right place at the right time? Not in the wrong place at the wrong time? Come on. 1929 wasn't bad for everybody. 1929 was awesome for the people that had cash. Number two, in 2008, stock prices had wildly diverged from where the economic fundamentals said they should be. In other words, they crashed. They fell. And now it has happened again. You want an example? I have an example for you. Very famous one. How about Tesla? Tesla Motors. We love them. They're great. They're an electric car company. You know what they're talking about, right? The real sexy Lotus and the wonderful S model that they've got. Well, that's wonderful. It's great. Maybe they're finally making a profit, and that's wonderful. It's a $4 stock. Well, it should be a $4 stock. Friday, it closed over $112. Why is that? How could a company have 150 times earnings? That's what I'm talking about. Economic fundamentals say that the stock should be $4, and yet it is $120. That's what I mean. It's not just that stock, it's thousands of them. Number three, in early 2008, the average price of a gallon of gasoline rose substantially. I know this because my phone rang off the hook. Please, please, Brooks, build your electric cars. You remember when gas went up sharply? In fact, it went up so sharply, a lot of transportation businesses went out of business. Some of them had to be acquired, gobbled up. We had fuel surcharges coming in to people's municipal bills. Guess what? It's starting to happen again. Anybody look at the pump prices lately? Like last week when they rose above $3.80, went up 45 cents in a single day. Do you hear anything being said about it on the press? Do you hear anything? Any big red print headlines in the newspapers? No, you don't. Why? It's certainly hitting your pocketbook just like it did in 2008. Number four, new home prices. Just experienced their largest two-month drop since Lehman Brothers collapsed. You remember Lehman Brothers, don't you? Great big regional broker. They crashed because they were overextended. You talk to realtors. Oh, yeah, real estate's coming back. We're coming back, absolutely. You buy these foreclosures and get in while the interest rates are low. Home prices just experienced their largest two-month drop, except, of course, in D.C. In Washington, D.C., you can't find a home for love nor money. Oh, guess what? You also can't find a Ferrari, and you can't find a Lamborghini, and you can't find a 7 Series Mercedes, and you also can't find a Rolls Royce. And why is that? Well, because they're sold out. Washington, D.C. is awash in money right now. Number five, during the last financial crisis in 2008, the mortgage delinquency rate rose dramatically. Those are people that are missing their payments each month. That's what caused the housing bubble. You know, people that really had no business getting a mortgage in the first place because they'd only been on the job for 6 months, or they weren't earning enough money. They had more than 41% of their income in debt, but they got a home loan anyway. Surprise! Some of them never made a single solitary house payment. Not one. Some of them made some house payments and then some partial house payments and then stopped making house payments. And those homes were put on the market as foreclosures. It's happening again. Do you know who's buying up the homes now that the prices are dropping? It's not you. It's the realtors. The realtors are buying the houses. They're buying $150,000 houses for $50,000. Oh, and then they're putting them back on the market at $150,000. Well, come on. You can't blame them. Making 6% profit on a house when you can make 300% profit on a house, what would you do? Of course, it's a little bit of insider trading because the realtor knows before anybody else does that this sweetheart of a foreclosure is on the market. And that's what's happening. Your homes are now becoming their homes. Number six. Prior to the financial crash, there was a spike in the number of adjustable rate mortgages. These are called ARMs. This is where, oh, yes, we'll get you in at 2.5%. It's a great interest rate. Of course, in a year, if the interest rates go up, we can raise your interest rate, or after 5 years, or after 10 years. And what will happen is you'll find yourself paying 12, 13, 14, 16% when interest rates go back up again. That's how the banks protect themselves, so they're not locked into a long-term low-interest loan. Number seven, just before the last financial crisis in 2008, unemployment claims started skyrocketing. Well, initial claims for unemployment benefits are rising again. And once we hit the 400,000 level, we will officially be in the danger zone. Watch for next month. Watch for next month. Now, some people out there will say, well, we've had a steady rise, job creation for the last 40 months, a steady growth for the last 40 months. Let me tell you, Earth Explorers, 1.8% is not growth. It is not growth. When inflation is growing at 2 or 3% and the job creation or the economic growth is at 1.8%, you're not growing. You're shrinking. You're losing. I have a short clip I want to play for you. It is not what you would call typical employment, okay? But there is a whole subculture, a whole cash subculture of our society that provides absolutely no value whatsoever. They run their own hours. They're their own bosses. They pay no taxes. They probably don't vote. They have basically disconnected themselves completely from the economic engines of America. And yet they're present. And in this clip, I'm going to play for you on a single subway car with camera rolling, several of these individuals coming on the train plying their trades. Here we go. Listen up.
Excuse me, everybody. I hate to bother you, but I'm homeless and I could really use some spare change. If you have a dollar or a quarter, any kind of change will do. I really appreciate anything you can spare.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? My name is Jabari. I do not rob. I do not steal. I'm just out here trying to sell some candy to raise a little bit of money. Not for drugs or for my basketball team or nothing like that. But just to keep me off the streets and safe and out of my mom's house. Anything you like, I got mixed fruit, Welch's, fruit punch, Concord grape. Only a dollar. Welch's fruit snacks.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, my name is Tracy.
I'm Tracy.
We just took out a second mortgage on our
summer home in Nantucket.
So we're looking to get a little help this evening.
Second mortgages are ridiculous.
I mean, if we could just get $5 or $10.
We'd appreciate fresh bills.
Even
no,
if 50.
Nothing crispy or crusty.
All right, dickheads, listen up. Listen up. My taxes are through the roof. I didn't get my bonus this year. I can't even pay off my Ferrari. Somebody's paying the piper. Come on, it's payback time. I pay taxes for all of you. Do you have any money?
$50 would be great. We can put it down.
I don't need your money. I need your money.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I am from the Little Top Circus. I was kidnapped by the circus a few weeks ago. I am trying to raise money for my ransom. We lost the lion. They're blaming me. Do you like the clowns? Hello, ladies. I'm trying to raise money for my ransom.
Hey, everybody quiet down. Everybody, no soliciting on the train. I got a call from up front. No, quiet with the music. Everybody, if you're soliciting, get off the train now.
I don't want to hear it.
Off the train. You're not supposed to solicit on the train. Did I stutter? You get off the train. Get off the train.
Have a heart.
It's just a sketch.
Work hard, people.
Excuse me.
What?
You have something to say? Get off the train. I don't want to hear it. May I have everybody's attention, please? I'm sorry to trouble everybody. I'm trying to raise money for the Police Benevolent Association. If you could all contribute, that'd be much appreciated. Thank you so much.
All right. So there you have it. That's Panhandlers of New York, a subculture that we have pretty much in every single community in the country. That's obviously a little humor published by the Panhandlers of New York. But you get the idea. Unemployment claims are nearing that 400,000 level again. Watch for it next month and you will see we're nearing that again. By the way, the crash of 1929 occurred after post-war recovery and three recessions, back-to-back recessions. We are now at the third recession after a post-war situation. Number eight, continuing claims for unemployment benefits just spiked at the highest level since early 2009, which is right after the crash of 2008. We're now in 2013. Number nine, the yield on a 10-year treasury now up to 2.6%. We also saw the yield on a 10-year U.S. treasury rise significantly during the first half of 2008. Bonds are very popular ways of funding new business. People buy bonds because of that yield. That's what they put their money into. Because equity is not available, they use bonds. These are called 144A bonds. Number 10, according to Zero Hedge, whenever the annual change in core CAPEX, also known as the non-defense capital goods excluding aircraft shipments, goes negative, the U.S. has traditionally entered a recession. Guess what? It is rapidly heading toward negative territory again. Number 11, average hourly compensation in the United States experienced its largest drop since 2009. Early 2009 is when we saw full-time employment fall through the floor. Yes, we've been adding jobs, but wait till I tell you how they've been adding them. They're part-time jobs. They're not full-time jobs. They're also not jobs in areas that you have traditionally been trained. In other words, if you're an engineer, you might have to go to work at Taco Bell. Also, if you're working as a temp, you might have four jobs in a single year working for the same company doing four different contracts. But guess what? Each one of those deployments counts as a separate employment event, even though you're working for the same company. That's right. Number 12, in the month of June, spending at restaurants fell by the most we have seen since February of 2008. You know what I'm talking about. Restaurants are where people eat out. Why is that? Because they like the convenience and they can afford it. It costs about three times as much to eat out as it does to cook at home. If you go to the grocery and you buy groceries, you can get a couple hundred dollars worth of groceries and you can exist for a couple weeks on that. You cannot feed a family on $200 a week going out to eat all the time. Not going to happen. You're going to spend at least $15 to $20 per meal, three meals a day, $60 a day for a small family, 7 days a week is $420 a week. You see what I'm talking about? It's two to three times more expensive to eat out than what you can do eating at home. And you're probably going to eat better at home, too. Number 13, just before the last financial crisis, corporate earnings were very disappointing. It's happening again. Everyone's earnings are off. Number 14, margin debt spiked just before the dot-com bubble burst. It spiked just before the financial crisis of 2008, and it is spiking again right now. Now, what is margin debt? I'm glad you asked that question. In 1929, one of the main reasons that the market crashed is because people could buy stock on margin, which means you could put up $10 and you could margin $100 or even more of stock. Now, as long as the stock went up, that was great. You made money on $100 worth of stock. But if it went down, you had to make the $90 good. You had to make up the loss. That's called margin debt. When stocks begin to slide in that manner, or if you're buying naked short contracts or short contracts, if those stocks don't pay off, you have to make the margin call. Number 15, during 2008, the price of gold fell substantially. Hello, we were at $1,800 gold just a few months ago. We have now slid down to $1,200. Silver is so low right now at $21 an ounce. It's below the cost of production, which means it doesn't make any money to run the mine. It makes more money to sit on the silver in the ground and borrow against it and wait for the price of silver to go up than it does to produce it. That means that even if you wanted to buy a 1 ounce, 2 ounce, or a 1 ounce, 5 ounce, 10 ounce, or a 100 ounce bar of silver, you couldn't find it right now. Not at that price. You're not going to be able to buy for 21 or 22 or maybe even $23 an ounce. You're going to spend about 30% more than the spot price for silver to get it in your hands. Now, you can buy the bullion, but that's a bunch of bull, and you know it. The thing to own is the actual metal. You can't find it for the spot price. Number 16, global business confidence is now the lowest that it has been since the last recession. It has never been worse. Never, not even in 1929 was it as bad as it is now. Number 17, back in 2008, the U.S. national debt was rapidly rising to unsustainable levels. Well, in case you haven't noticed, the national debt clock, you know, the one that runs like a fast-speed odometer, well, it stopped running about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Well, it doesn't mean that the debt wasn't going up. It is. It's just that they're not displaying it. Why? Because if it gets to a certain point, it passes the debt ceiling, which means that the government cannot pay its bills by borrowing money. It has to actually earn money to pay its bills. Now, if you remember, or you were listening to Fox News Sunday this morning with Treasury Secretary Liu on TV, he was stating, we need to end this practice of bringing the country to this debt level all the time where we're getting ready to shut down the government. We need to have an executive order doing away with the debt ceiling. In other words, we just keep writing bad checks for infinity. Because, after all, the United States has to be able to pay its bills. But if you're paying your bills with borrowed money, then you're constantly borrowing money on top of borrowed money. There's no way back. No way back unless you start reducing the size of government. Number 18, prior to the last financial crisis, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke assured the American people that home prices would not decline, that there would not be a recession. Well, history is what history is. Today, Treasury Secretary Liu said, read my lips, no new spending cuts. Sequester is a bad thing. It's bad that it's all being applied to military. They want to not apply it all to military and sort of spread it around among the other agencies. Don't listen to this nonsense, because that's not what's going to happen. The reason that spending has slowed is because of sequester. The reason that we're showing what little tiny growth we are, 1.8%, is because of sequester. What we should do is we should implement sequester through all the agencies. It works so well on the military, we need to do it everywhere. Now, just in case you are feeling safe and secure, the federal government has estimated that it has nearly doubled the number of data centers it had in 2011. It now totals, I know, you think about the one in Utah. You think about the one in Moses Lake, Washington. Well, that's only two. We now have over 7,000 data centers in the United States. As the Federal Times noted, the Obama administration estimated the government had about 3,100 data centers in June of 2011. Well, guess what? In June of 2013, just a month ago, a recount yielded more than 6,000. Now that number has grown again to 7,145. Representative John Mica, Republican from Florida, Chairman of the House Subcommittee on Governmental Operations, said the government will never meet its goal of consolidating data centers at its current pace. A government official said that the number of data centers has grown because of changes in the counting methodology and because of agencies discovered more data centers that had previously been unaccounted for. David Powner, the Director of Information Technology Management Issues at the GAO, the General Accounting Office, agreed. There are some fundamental questions about whether the government really knows what it has. The federal government will have one more data center when it opens a massive NSA data storage facility in Utah this fall. By the way, that thing is going to use millions of gallons of water a year to cool the computers. Actually, I think it's kind of a cool thing. No, not having 7,000 data centers, but consolidating it all into one location. That makes the target so much easier, don't you think? Also, in the last half hour here, I want to mention there are some similarities, many more similarities, as to what was going on in history and what's going on now. As you know, X Squared Radio is the place where the past meets the future. We try to bring the patterns of yesteryear and match them up with the patterns of today to see if we're doing the same stupid things we've always done. Have we learned our lessons? Have we guided ourselves to a newer, more peaceful, more prosperous planet? I think the general consensus is no. Well, one more piece I want to add to this, and I have to thank my guest from last month. Her name was Diana West. She penned a marvelous book called American Betrayal. And I highly recommend that you go back last month, listen to Diana West's interview, and pick up the book American Betrayal. It is a book about a Soviet invasion of Washington, D.C. during World War II, right after World War I, as a matter of fact. By the time World War II was declared, and all during the time when we fought both theaters of the war, Washington, D.C. was inundated with Soviet spies, not the least of which was Harry Hopkins, who worked inside Franklin Delano Roosevelt's office, and he was often called the co-president. As you know, Roosevelt was the very popular and charismatic governor of New York. In those days, you just didn't have media like you do today. So in order to win a national election, you had to have national name recognition. Roosevelt had that as governor of New York. So he was elected. But you also know that Roosevelt had polio. And in those days, when you suffered from polio where you were wheelchair bound, it comes with all kinds of complications. You get blood clots. You have issues with the blood pressure and strokes. And that's exactly what happened to Roosevelt. Roosevelt was elected four times. Shortly after his fourth election is when the constitutional change was made, where the president was suggested to only work for two terms, term limits on the presidency. By the time Roosevelt hit his second term, he wasn't thinking as clearly as he did when he began. We're not really sure why. It could have had to do with diet. It could have had to do with drugs he was taking, whatever. But good old Harry Hopkins stepped in and made all the policy. And if you go back and listen to the interview, you're going to find some terrific information that will let you know why we did the things that we did during World War II, why Russia or Soviet Union ended up virtually controlling half of Europe until Reagan became president and finally defeated them in the Cold War. Well, I got news for you. All those Soviet spies never left Washington. There was no mass exodus when the war was over out of Washington. They didn't sell all their homes and leave. Thousands of them are still there. And now they're joined by thousands of Islamic activists and spies. We already see that in Houma. I'm just going to call it the media wife of Anthony Weiner. She was also the assistant to Hillary Clinton in the State Department. She is associated with Hamas. That's a terrorist organization in the Middle East that's responsible for assassinations. President Obama has an assassination methodology wherein he uses drones to attack targeted peoples in foreign countries, and he's killed several hundred innocents in collateral damage as well. Houma is just one of many Islamic spies that work in Washington. Well, have we learned from our mistakes of the past? We are now ensconced or embroiled in a debate which has been going on for 5 years now about national health care. Even though it's undeniably true from a historical standpoint, Barack Obama, the Democrat Party, and their accomplices in the big media will vilify you, ridicule you, and accuse you of minimizing the tragedy of the Holocaust. But I don't really care if they play that card here on X Squared Radio, because we have the facts. They've already played the race card. They've already played the Nazi card. We've already played the extremist card, blah, blah, blah. Consider me inoculated, okay, from the venomous poison of these vipers. It doesn't work here. Here are the facts that you should know before accepting a nationalized healthcare system that will place in the hands of government the very keys to your life, your liberty, and your pursuit of happiness. Are you ready? These are the facts. Don't listen to any rhetoric. Don't listen to any of the speeches and C-SPAN and blah, blah, blah. These are the facts. This is history. May we learn as the past meets the future right here on X Squared Radio. Adolf Hitler didn't launch National Socialist Healthcare in Germany. It began in the latter part of the 19th century under Otto von Bismarck. Ironically, as part of his anti-socialist legislation, Bismarck, like many of today's U.S. politicians, believed introducing a form of what I call socialism light would stave off the more virulent forms of the disease. The Weimar Republic that preceded the Nazi takeover had already witnessed the transformation of the German healthcare system from one focused on individual practitioners, doctors, and individual patients, to one more concerned with general public health. Prevention became the watchword. Doctors became more like state functionaries concerned with the nation's general health than individuals accountable to patients for health care. When a worldwide economic crisis hit in 1929, government expenditures for health care were slashed, as were those for public housing, welfare payments, and creative programs. The government health care system began to apply cost efficiency calculations to medical treatments. Sound familiar? The first victims were those considered weak and unproductive to the interests of the state. The eugenicist ideas of Planned Parenthood, founded under Margaret Sanger, a hero of today's collectivists promoting socialized medicine, were studied and adopted by the Germans. Charles Darwin's notions about survival of the fittest were applied to social engineering practices and policies. Before Hitler ever came to power, Germans were already euthanizing or sterilizing large numbers of the mentally ill and the mentally retarded. Just as today's American Medical Association embraces socialized medicine, so did its German counterparts support the Nazi expansion of state manipulation of medical care for state purposes. One of the first Nazi-era laws was the Law for the Prevention of Progeny of Hereditary Disease. Sound familiar? Which prohibited reproduction by those deemed genetically inferior. With it came the institution of a genetic health court. Sound familiar? Death panel? Of judges and doctors whose their job was to determine who should be forcibly sterilized based on the state's extremely limited knowledge of genetics. By 1935, Nazi Germany was performing forced abortions up to the 6 month of pregnancy. Well, we're now doing it well beyond that. We're doing it in the 36th week of pregnancy. Thousands and thousands of handicapped children were killed by pediatricians under the direction of Ernst Wenzler of the German Children's Hospital in Berlin. Other medical researchers, including the infamous Joseph Mengele, used the children in their own gruesome and tortuous experiments. It's still happening. Ultimately, of course, all this desensitization of state-approved and state-conducted murder and mayhem led directly to genocide, the attempted systematic destruction of the Jews in Europe. They were an easy scapegoat. I'm not going to get into the anti-Semitism that went into it. It's historic, and you can read about it. Now, am I suggesting that socialized medicine of the kind being promoted in America today leads inevitably to Holocaust and mass murder? No. But I am saying it is a necessary prerequisite for government-directed Holocaust and mass murder to occur. It's setting it up to occur. Once the state feels the full brunt and burden of what it will take to maintain the health of 15% of this country by population that has a pre-existing condition that renders them unsurvivable, once the state begins to feel that burden, they will begin to make decisions. Believe me, it already happens on a state level. Every single state that has tried this inside the United States has experienced the same thing. They go from budget surpluses to terrible deficits. Why? Why would that happen if everybody in that state, everybody in the population participates in the system? Because it's human nature. If you're contributing $1,000 a month to the healthcare system and you're healthy, you never go to the doctor. You don't need the doctor. You haven't broken a bone. You don't have a disease. That's 85% of the United States lives just like that. They could pay their health care year by year cash out of their pocket. They get sick. They go to the doctor. They pay their own doctor's visit. They buy their own drugs. They take the drugs, get the treatment, and they go back to health again. You think those people, after being forced to pay $1,000 a month, are not going to go to the doctor? Doesn't happen. In the United States of America, we clean our plate. That means if you go to a restaurant and you order food and they bring you that 16-ounce bone-in porterhouse and that 2.5-pound baked potato slathered with butter and sour cream and chives and a salad big enough to feed a family of four, you're going to eat it because you paid for it. We are a full plate, clean your plate society. We're taught not to waste things. So if you've got a family of four parents and two kids, and you're paying $1,000 a month in health care, guess where you're going to go when your kid gets the sniffles? Guess where you're going to go when your baby has an ear infection? Guess where you're going to go when you have to lose a little bit of weight or have a little mole taken off the side of your shoulder or have a hair transplant or elective surgery on a knee that's been bothering you while you play tennis? That's right. You're going to use that healthcare system. And what's going to happen is the 15% that should be benefiting from everybody being in the healthcare system is going to go right back to 90 or 95% of the people using the healthcare system. And it isn't going to work. It's going to bury the country. And that's when the country and the state begins to make decisions. It is also clear that the kind of state-enforced medical rationing and the politicization of medicine observed in Germany before and during Hitler's reign of terror would not be possible without that first step of nationalized health care. Now, this doesn't mean that Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and Harry Reid are little Hitlers in the making. I'm not calling them Nazis, though they share some common values and common friends with the German National Socialists. I am saying their statist work in the area of so-called healthcare reform can make it possible for some future American version of Hitler to carry out his most diabolical plans. It's the setup. It's the organization. The fact that it is state-run, state-decided, state-funded, you can't back out of it. There is no private alternative. There is no competition to it. And once the state begins to make policy changes that are designed to limit the liability, financial liability, it makes it so much easier for those things to fall into place. Inoculations, birth control, sterilizations. It's a slippery slope, and it begins with a nice thick coat of hog lard called national health care. Try to find in that document any hint of a government power to be responsible for essential services like food, housing, medical care. It isn't there. And it isn't there for a very good reason. The government is supposed to be dependent on the people, not the people on the government. Now, what are you going to do about it? Probably nothing. Why would you do nothing? Because you've been lulled into a sense of complacency. I can't do anything about it. It doesn't matter who I vote for. They're all going to do the same thing. Everybody's on the same team. It doesn't matter who you vote for. Well, there are more insidious things. Have you ever heard about, someone being as dumb as dust? I know you have. Have you ever met one? Of course. But what would you do if I told you there's such a thing as smart dust? Yeah. Some might have heard about smart dust. Nanoparticles that can be employed as sensor networks for a range of security and environmental applications. Now, however, literal smart dust for the brain is being proposed as the next step toward establishing a brain-computer interface. No, I'm serious. It's already being tried in the gaming industry. Okay, it's a neurological gadget. The system is officially called Neural Dust. Now, it works to monitor the brain from the inside. You know how you put the little electric pads on the outside, and we do an electroencephalogram. We map out the brain waves as little squiggles by an ink pen, or now it's done on a screen. But the inventors are attempting to overcome the hurdle of how to best implant the sensors that can remain over the course of one's life. Researchers at Berkeley Engineering believe they have found a novel way to achieve this. This is not science fiction. I'm not making this up. This is real. You can check it out. You want proof? Please write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will send it to you. This paper explores the fundamental system design trade-offs and ultimate size, power, and bandwidth scaling limits of neural recording systems. Oh, and it's sophisticated. A network of tiny implantable sensors could function like an MRI inside the brain, recording data on nearby neurons and transmitting it back out of the brain to a receiver. The smart dust particles would all contain an extremely small CMOS sensor capable of measuring electrical activity in nearby neurons. The researchers envision a piezoelectric material backing the CMOS capable of generating electrical signals from ultrasound waves. That's how your inkjet printer works, is with the little piezoelectric crystals. It applies a simple pulse. The piezoelectric crystal vibrates. The vibration pushes the ink through the little tiny portal of the inkjet printer, and it squirts it down on your paper, and it can do it at very high speeds now. The process would also occur in reverse, allowing the dust, guess what, to beam data back via high-frequency sound waves. The neural dust would also be coated with polymer that keeps it from being eroded or detected by the body's immune system. So once you ingest the dust, either by snorting it up the nose or absorbing it through the skin, it's in there, and your body's never going to get rid of it because it doesn't see it as a foreign invader. The investment in neuroscience has received already a $100 million commitment via Obama's Brain Project, while Europe has committed $1.3 billion to build a supercomputer replica of the brain in a similarly comprehensive and detailed fashion as the Human Genome Project mapped DNA. The Brainwaves project is divided into four modules, each tasked with studying the impact of developments in the field of neuroscience and neurotechnology. The titles of the modules reflect the areas of examination. You check out your local universities in the bioinformatics area and see if these modules don't exist. Number one. Now, you might think to yourself, what the heck does this have to do with bioinformatics? What does this have to do with medicine? What does this have to do with diagnostics? Listen closely, please. Module one, society and policy. Module two, implications for education and lifelong learning. Module three, conflict and security. Module four, responsibility and the law. The results from these modules have been published and clearly illustrate how this panel views the lower public masses in light of their status as the elite arbiters of human destiny. The dual approach to this investigation must be kept in mind as the U.S. government is now rolling out the BRAIN initiative as the next great thing since the Human Genome Project. The ramifications are potentially even more momentous. We often hear from critics that these think tanks are an essential part of scientific discovery and that drawing conclusions of a nefarious nature about their intent, well, it's just paranoid conspiracy theory. They are only thinking, after all. I would submit that the objective scientific inquiry is absolutely necessary at this moment in time, and that the proper role of science is to disseminate results to the public for open debate prior to their implementation. However, think tanks such as the Royal Society betray, by their own language, subjective biases and corporate connections that have no place in true science. Concurrently, there is massive long-term investment in nanotech applications via the National Nanotechnology Initiative 2011 Strategic Plan. And pay close attention, because I personally attended the nanotechnology transfer in Jiangsu City, China. I attended personally. I was there. The technology is already being transferred to China. This 60-page document lays out a projected future to understand and control matter. For the management of every facet of human life within the surveillance matrix of environment, health, and safety. 25 U.S. federal agencies are already participating. Agencies, departments, bureaus, administrations, all receiving billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer funding. The concept of smart dust has been applied and or proposed for use in the following ways, just to name a few. Nanosensors for the use in agriculture that measure crops and environmental conditions. Sounds innocuous enough. Bomb-sniffing plants using rewired DNA to detect explosives and biological agents. Smart dust, motes that wirelessly transmit data on temperature, light, and movement. This can also be used in currency to track cash. However, this is just the first time that there is a working plan to apply smart dust to the human brain. Researchers claim it will be some time before, if ever, this is workable. We talk about mapping the human brain. You don't have to. The only thing you have to do is control the emission and level of hormones in the human body. All you have to do is give humans enough serotonin to make them feel good. Or if you're trying to inspire soldiers, you just scale up the nano dust to make the soldier fearless. So he will go into battle no matter what, face down anything. Each particle of neural dust contains these CMOS sensors, and they can receive and send information. Once they're close to the synapses of the brain that are responsible for the emission of these various hormones and enzymes, you can control the mind. You can control the mind's effect. You might not be able to actually map the brain for total mind control, but you can control how a person might feel. They might feel content. They might feel anxious. They might sleep insensitively. They might not sleep. You might wear them out with fatigue. That's why SEO and CO individuals, that's search engine optimization, they've chosen ultrasound to send and receive the data. They calculate that the power required to use electromagnetic waves as the scale would generate a damaging amount of heat because of the amount of energy that would actually enter the body and it'd be absorbed. By contrast, though, ultrasound is much more efficient and should allow the transmission of at least 10 million times more power than electromagnetic waves. In other words, all you really have to do is use harp and layer the ultrasound underneath the harp carrier frequencies, and you can cover huge amounts of the population in a very low-power manner. Once the population in that area has been exposed to the nanodust with these tiny CMOS circuits, you can then control chemical balances inside of that human being. In case anyone believes that this has little chance of success, don't bank on it. MIT highlights that one of the authors of the research has already achieved this with a remote-controlled beetle. The human brain is clearly a vast, perhaps infinite complexity. And this is without even introducing concepts such as the mind or the soul. Nevertheless, it's clear that if you can control the body, if you can control the physiology of the body, you will more than likely control most of the brains in our society. It doesn't take much. Think about it. How many people do you know that are really ruled by their stomach, by their passions? They don't think. They don't reason things out. They only go about how they feel. And they can be moved. They can be moved easily with one kind of rhetoric or another. Even music can move people. Well, anyway, we're out of time, and I wish I could spend more time, but we're out. So this is X Squared Radio signing off till next week.